From Santa Barbara, California, Timeless Voyager Radio with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers in the fields of environmental issues, alternative healthcare, new psychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. My guest is Zechariah Sitchin. He is an author and a speaker. The man has written a number of books, and I'd like to go over them. First of all, they're published by Avon. The books include what he calls the Earth Chronicles, The 12th Planet, The Stairway to Heaven, The Wars of Gods and Men, The Lost Realms, Genesis Revisited, and Book 5 of the Earth Chronicles, When Time Began, which is the newest book. Zechariah Sitchin is the guest. Welcome to my show.
Hi.
I think we should really start, for those listeners who may not be familiar with your work, with the fact that you are one of the few people who can translate the tablets, which basically refer to a period of time, a long time ago, but you have a differing philosophical view. Why don't you explain to our listeners why you see the Sumerians as a little bit different from the way most translators do?
Well, the Sumerian civilization, which blossomed out in what today is Iraq or southern Iraq about 6,000 years ago, is by now well known from archaeological missions and discoveries, both through the various artifacts that were found, through the remains of quite a number of major cities and high-rise temples, and mostly from thousands upon thousands of clay tablets on which the Sumerians wrote down almost anything that we write today on paper, be it such mundane things as lists of tax collections, to marital contracts, to temple rituals, and to tales of historic and prehistoric events, prehistoric to them, events that had taken place long, long ago, and which say that first there is one more planet in our solar system in addition to all the planets we know of and they knew of, and they depicted one more, and that people, beings, intelligent beings that look very much like us, because in the course of events they made us to look very much like them, came here for their own reasons and got involved with mankind and gave us all the knowledge that the ancient peoples had. Now, the difference, Bruce, between me and other scholars is not in acknowledging the existence of all this information, because I never lay claim that I went and dug and found those objects or those tablets. They are all discovered by others. They are in various museums. The texts are known. The texts were published. The difference is that others treat these texts of prehistorical events as mythology, as, you know, tales that, made-up tales, let's say. I said, what if these are not myths, but actual records of actual events? That these are not imaginary so-called gods, as the Greeks started to call them thousands of years later, but of actual beings who did live on another planet and did come to Earth and did do all kinds of things. So this is the only, well, the major difference between me and other scholars, not in acknowledging the existence of the evidence, but in their saying it's a myth, and in my saying, what if it's not a myth? What if it all really happened? And once you say, what if it all really happened, a scenario, a very plausible scenario that explains many things, both in science, in biblical scholarship, and so on, and everything falls into place if you say, probably, maybe, what if it all really happened.
We're going to talk a lot about his new book, When Time Began, but we need to talk a little bit about time. Now, you have some interesting data here, just basic time linear, and we're looking at time linearly. Why don't you give us and our listeners a little bit of an idea of what framework we're talking about? We're talking about hundreds of thousands of years, aren't we?
Yes, according to the Sumerians, and these, again, I'm stressing, these are inscriptions that were found, deciphered, are in various museums, be it in the British Museum in London or in the Louvre in Paris or in the museum Philadelphia, the Museum of the University of Pennsylvania, and so on. So these are lists of events that began 432,000 years before the Great Flood, the Deluge. And according to the data that I put together, the deluge happened about between 11, 12 to 13,000 years ago. And thus we are talking about events that began to unfold almost 450,000 years ago.
Now, for us, we think of we think of history as going back, let's say, to the time of Christ, and pretty much even only 2,000 years ago seems very quick. As a matter of fact, you actually call a divine day 1,000 years, don't you?
The Bible does. The Bible says that in the eyes of God, 1,000 years is just as one day. And this has to do, Bruce, with many people are aware of it, but are aware of it maybe in connection with the Mayan calendar or with Hindu religious and other prehistorical tales and texts. But it really all began with the Sumerians, this notion of cycles of time within cycles of time. Now, the 432,000 years of events before the deluge are really, in Sumerian text, 120 sars. The sar represented an orbit of 3,600 years, which was the orbit, or maybe still is, the orbit of the planet, called Nibiru, by the way, meaning planet of the crossing, from which the other people came to Earth. So they counted their year as one orbit around the sun. To us on Earth, it represented 3,600 Earth years. And that is a cycle that I call in my new book, When Time Began, a divine time. Then we Earthlings are used to a time scale, a much smaller or faster time scale, connected with our own orbit around the sun, which to us is 1 year, connected to the orbit of the moon around our Earth, which is gives us the month, and of course the turning of our planet around its own axis, which gives us the 24-day-night cycle, which also goes back to Sumerian times, the number 24, 12, etc. So there was a need for some kind of a ratio, because I spoke just very recently in England at the meeting in Salisbury, which is the central town around which are the remains of Stonehenge at Silbury Hill, etc. And of course, arriving there, I was under the effects of a jet lag, and I said, imagine the jet lag of somebody who comes from a planet that has a 3,600-year orbit and lands on a planet that has a 1-year orbit. So there was a need for some kind of another scale, creating some proportion between that, and that is the invention, I suggest, by the visitors to Earth of the zodiac, the division of the circle around the sun, the heavenly circle, into 12 parts and a constellation of stars in each one of them, as I show in my books, and you mentioned that I sometimes speak in, when I show slides, that the names of the zodiacal constellations, their pictorial depictions, etc., go back to the Sumerians 6,000 years ago, and each mathematically, each zodiacal house occupies a span of 2,160 years, which is a ratio of 6 to 10 to the 3,600-year orbit. So this is the, by the way, the origin of the golden section, the golden number, the ratio of 10 to 6. So there are three time scales. One is ours, which I call earthly time. One is theirs, which is the 3,600 divine time. And there is the intermediary ratio, the creation of the zodiac, and whether the zodiacal changes every 2,100 years or so mean anything or don't mean anything or bode some things for the future, because we are now about to change from the zodiacal age of Pisces to that of Aquarius, is really something that I discuss in my new book.
All right, now let's just back up a second. There are a few things that you have mentioned, and I'd like people to have a chance to understand them. First of all, Nibiru is the planet that you feel is the 12th planet. That is what the Sumerians called the planet. Matter of fact, they refer to that as a planet that they got all of their information from. Is that correct?
Not from the planet, from those who came from it.
Right, I'm sorry, I should have said that. Now, the people that came from that planet, do we refer to them as the Anunnaki?
So we have to be precise, right.
I'm just saying, they were the Anunnaki?
The Anunnaki, correct.
All right, the Anunnaki were the descendants from the planet Nibiru, is that correct?
Right, but literally it means, Bruce, in Sumerian, Anunnaki, those who from heaven to earth came.
All right, now we have that word. Let us use this term, Nephilim. What is that, and how did that fit into the story?
Well, the Nephilim fits into the story in several ways. And first of all, it fits into my personal story because I got involved in the subject, in the study of ancient civilizations and the study of Sumerian and the study of mythology and all that goes with it. Because when I was a schoolboy, fortunately studying the Bible, the Old Testament, in its original Hebrew language, we reached chapter 6 of Genesis, which is the story of Noah and the Ark and the deluge, etc. And that story begins with several, I believe, 8 very enigmatic verses. That are made famous by many preachers because they sort of set the time frame for the deluge and say that those were the days when there were giants upon the earth and they married the daughters of men and so on and so forth. And that's what the teacher explained, that there were giants upon the earth. And I don't know, age 9, 10, something like that, raised my hand and said, but excuse me, my teacher, the word used in the Bible is Nephilim, which means those who had come down from heaven to earth. So why do you say giants? And I was expecting, to be congratulated for my acumen, for my, sharp knowledge of the Hebrew language. And instead I was reprimanded. He said, sit down. You don't question the Bible. And I remember, though it happened many years ago, that I came home. I was really hurt because I was not questioning the Bible. On the contrary, I was trying to uphold the correctness, the precision of the Bible. And instead I'm getting reprimanded. So as time went on and I began to study, you know, biblical studies and the archaeology of the Holy Land and so on, this kept nagging at me. Who were the Nephilim? Why did the Bible call them by that very precise word? And in time I discovered that it all goes back to the Sumerian civilization, and that Nephilim in Hebrew really is the Hebrew equivalent of the Sumerian Anunnaki. So if you want to hearken to the Bible, we can use in this interview the word Nephilim, which is a Hebrew word. If you want, we can use the Sumerian Anunnaki.
All right. Now, I think the thing that I, of course, enjoyed very much was to find out that the Anunnaki had a reason for coming to the Earth, and I think people need to hear this because it certainly changes what we feel about the importance of ourselves. So why don't you just quickly sum up why the Anunnaki came here and why we were created?
Okay. I'll tell you. I'll enlarge a little on it because though I started researching who were the Nephilim, I don't know, by now it's almost 40 years ago. By the time it became clear to me that we are talking about visitors to Earth, you can call them ancient astronauts, you can call them extraterrestrials, you can call them, as the Greeks did, gods, with a small g. By that time, there were current some books in Europe and here, suggesting that some of the enigmatic structures on Earth, like, say, the Great Pyramids of Giza in Egypt, could not have been built by humans at that time. They didn't have the technology, they didn't have the sciences. So somebody else, perhaps from another planet, perhaps a visitor, perhaps an ancient astronaut, did it. So I felt at the time that just to repeat that, you know, I'm not contributing anything. I felt that if somebody takes the subject seriously, a series of questions must be answered. If they came here, when did they come? It's not enough to say, well, you know, sometime in the past. It's not enough to say, well, they came, I don't know from where. From where did they come? If it's from somewhere else, from another planet, another star system, whatever, was it an accident? Did they crash land here? Or were they coming and going? Now, space travel is a major undertaking for any civilization with any technology. So if they kept coming and going, as the Sumerian texts make evident, why? I mean, you know, we visited the moon once, and so far it's enough, unless we have a reason to go back for minerals or as a way station to other planets or whatever. There must be a reason. So the why became very important, as you have suggested. And I found that they came for a very mundane reason. Evidently, they were losing the atmosphere, perhaps also the heat, the internal heat on their own planet. And in order to support life on their planet, their scientists decided that the only way would be to create a shield of suspended gold particles above their atmosphere. This, by the way, quite interestingly, some who feel that Mars, which had an atmosphere and water, etc., not much longer than about 10,000 years ago, could be revived by, guess what, creating a shield of suspended gold particles above the existing thin atmosphere. And this would create a cycle of heating up and creating a thicker atmosphere and unfreezing some of the water, etc. So almost 500,000 years ago, somebody on Nibiru had the same idea. So they came here for gold, and at first they tried to obtain it from the waters of the Persian Gulf. That's where they set up, on the shores of the Persian Gulf, their first settlement. But when it did not go according to plan, and they started to do it the hard way by mining gold in southeastern Africa, a point in time came when the few of them who were involved in that mutinied. There's a long text that describes the mutiny and the reasons for it. And they said no more. And then their chief scientist, whose name was Enki, said, I have a solution. There already exists a being on Earth that can do the work for us. All we need to do is put our mark on it. And then there are several texts, not just one, several, that detail a process of genetic engineering, of mixing the genes of one of their young with the egg of an, let's call her an ape woman, who was on Earth already through evolution. This is about 300,000 years ago. And they, after some trial and error, which are also described, brought about us, Homo sapiens. So we were created, according as the Bible says, the Adam, not the man called Adam, but the Adam, which literally means the earthling. We were created, as the Bible says, to do the work for the Anunnaki. And it was only in time and mostly after the deluge that the relationship changed. But in the beginning, we were created in Sumerian to be Lulu Amelus, primitive workers.
I hate to leave this information because it's so good, but you know, we need to talk a little bit about Stonehenge. Why does Sir Flinders Petrie, Sir Norman Lockyer, William Stukeley, Cecil A. Newham, and most recently Gerald S. Hawkins, why do they feel that Stonehenge is so important?
Well, they more than feel that important. They are amazed by it because from ideas or notions not too many decades ago, that this is some kind of an open-air temple, you know, where either human sacrifices or other sacrifices were held, or some other celebrations of religious or quasi-religious nature were taking place in prior centuries. These scholars whom you listed, and all of them are great scientists, by the way, in mathematics, in astronomy, and so on, in archaeology, were astounded to discover, as some of them have said, that Stonehenge is a stone computer that not only tracks but can predict the movements of the sun and the moon and the earth and their correlations, that can predict eclipses, both of sun and moon, and that is very precisely aligned to the summer solstice, that's when the sun rises on midsummer, June 21st, and the longest day in the northern hemisphere. And some of them, I think it was Hawkins, that said that it needed a veritable Einstein to conceive, to be the architect of such a monument, which is circles within circles within circles, and to determine the exact spot on Earth in the northern hemisphere where it should be located. So Stonehenge is amazing, and to me, the key to the enigma was the date of Stonehenge. There are two key dates. There was Stonehenge 1, the first Stonehenge, around 3100 BC, and there is the second Stonehenge, more or less in the shape whose remains can be seen today, around 2100 BC. And why it happened that exactly those 2 days gave me the key, I believe, the first time true key to the solution of the Stonehenge enigma.
So the point here, I guess, is that Stonehenge, as you have said, is not just some pagan ritual area, but in actuality, you call it probably the first computer, or at least the first computer that we know of.
It was a stone computer for astronomical and calendrical purposes.
Now, of course, the question that will come up, obviously, is why would anyone need, and I'm going to lead you into this, why would anyone need this on the planet Earth since at that time, supposedly, all there were apes on the Earth?
Well, I'd like to say that the answer is in my book, so can I suggest that people read it?
Absolutely.
But you want more than that.
Not necessarily. Maybe you could give them a little bit of a hint, though.
It had to do with the changing of the zodiac at that time. Around 3100 BC, it's not so easy to discuss it in a few minutes, but around 3100 BC, major events were taking place both in the Old World and in the New World. Many, I hope, have followed several books on the Maya calendar, and they had two calendars. One of them is called the Long Count, which counted the passage of days from a certain unknown, mysterious, enigmatic event, which has been fixed at precisely some specific day in August, equivalent to August 3113 BC. And that cycle, that calendar, had to do with the appearance in the Americas of a so-called god called Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent, who came, gave knowledge, gave civilization, gave the calendar, gave the knowledge of mathematics, instructed the local people in the construction of the pyramids, the step pyramids, and then left promising to return. This ties in with what happened when the Spaniards arrived.
We talked a little bit about Stonehenge. We need to kind of jump ahead a little bit. You started talking just a moment about pyramids. Why do we have pyramids here on the planet?
Well, the initial pyramids, which were in Mesopotamia, where the Sumerian civilization began, were actually residences of the Anunnaki, the leaders. Each member of the pantheon of 12, which was then replicated in Greek mythology or Greek beliefs, the Olympian 12, 12 disciples of Jesus, by the way, 12 months and so on, that's the origin of 12. These were the Sumerian word that is translated in a text in English or German or whatever, as house, as temple. The word really meant house. That was the house of the Lord. By the way, in the Bible, too, Solomon's temple is called the house of the Lord. So these were actual residences of what I believe were not mythological figures, but actual beings who had come to Earth. So this was the origin of the pyramids. Then they became the observatories where the astronomer priests or priest astronomers, you can look at it either way, because originally astronomy and religion were one and the same. That was where they resided. That is where they made the observations. So from houses of the gods, let's say, they became the celestial observatories that determined the calendar, that determined when festivals had to take place and when other major events. And around 2100 BC, major events were taking place, because that was the time of the zodiacal change from Taurus to Aries, and each planet and each month were associated with one member of the pantheon of 12, so were the zodiacs, and therefore a change of the zodiac signified or was interpreted as a change in the hierarchy, who would now become the principal one of the Anunnaki to be the supreme on Earth. And this led to wars, this led to eventual use of nuclear weapons on Earth, a story which is echoed in the biblical tale of Sodom and Gomorrah in the time of Abraham, and to many, many other changes which I describe in this new book, changes in religion, changes in desire, changes for the worse. The Sumerian civilization came to an end, society and science declined, the status of women, which was who were totally equal before, the status of women changed for the worse, and so on and so forth. So all this happened around 2100 BC, and at that time, the god that the Mesoamericans called Quetzalcoatl, and in regard to whose arrival they counted back to 3113 BC, is the same god that the Egyptians called Thoth, who was forced by a rival brother to leave Egypt around the same time, and the Greeks later called him Hermes. So all these events connected with Stonehenge 1 and Stonehenge 2, and as I show in my book, parallel structures at the same times, both in the Americas, whether it's Mesoamerica or South America, in Cusco, which is the became later the Inca capital, and others in Machu Picchu, the so-called lost city of the Incas, and even in Sumer itself, I show that in Sumer itself, at exactly the same time, there was a mini Stonehenge erected on the shores of the Euphrates River. So this was a more or less a global phenomenon connected with the events that were taking place at that time. So what the lessons are for us as we are about to change from one age to another is food for thought.
Now, you, of course, 40 years is a long time to be working on this kind of information and to be bringing it forward and then having people, let's say, 40 years later start discovering it. What is the reaction now, let's say, as opposed to maybe your reaction that people gave you 15 years ago? How has it changed?
Well, the change has been gradual and cumulative. I recall some of the first say radio interviews, like we're having now, when the first book was published in 1976, and the comment was could be summed up in the words amazing evidence, credible but incredible. In other words, the data is there, the evidence is there, but it's really hard to believe. Now, the first book, The 12th Planet, dealt mostly with the Sumerian evidence as augmented by the biblical evidence. The second book, The Stairway to Heaven, drew in the Egyptian evidence and thus enhanced the information, brought in the question of the pyramids, who built the pyramids, why they were they built, and so on. Not by the pharaohs, but by the Anunnaki. Then the third book, The Wars of Gods and Men, took the story a little closer to our times, involving heavily the biblical evidence. The fourth book, The Lost Realms, switched the viewing device. I wasn't sure whether to say the telescope or the microscope, but the viewing device to the Americas, and showed that the cultures there were connected to the cultures in the so-called Old World, that the same Anunnaki who were in one place came to the other place for the same reasons, by the way, in search of gold or in need for gold, and thus linked the two worlds, the old and the new, discarded, by the way, the notion that men appeared in the Americas only when during the last ice age they could trek over the ice covering the Bering Strait. And since the book was published, most scientists now agree that men arrived in the Americas 20 and 30 and maybe 40,000 years ago, and that they somehow crossed both the Atlantic Ocean and both the Pacific Ocean. They say they did, we don't know how. I said years earlier in my book, they did with the aid of the Anunnaki. That's how. The book that you mentioned, which is considered a companion book, Genesis Revisited, did something that really changed attitudes, not just among the general readership, but in the scientific community. Its subtitle is Modern Science Catching Up with Ancient Knowledge? And I've taken one field of science after the other. Astronomy, geology, genetics, medicine, geography, and so on and so forth, and showed how in one field after the other, what we are discovering nowadays has already been known in antiquity, has been recorded and reported by the Sumerians 6,000 years ago. And when one says, well, how could they know without telescopes and microscopes and all that? The answer is given by the Sumerians themselves. They said clearly, all that we know was taught to us by the Anunnaki. So the knowledge they had, which is incredible, came from more advanced people who came to Earth from Nibiru. So by now you find that... you know, I'm invited to speak at at scientific or university forums. More and more, you know, let's call them establishment scientists. Scientists write me letters and say, I agree with you. The evidence is convincing. It's very interesting. For example, there is a major scientist that has been in this country, now he's a visiting professor in Australia, was so impressed by my books that he's originally from Czechoslovakia. He offered, if I agreed, to translate free of charge a Genesis Revisited into Czech, into the Czech language. So it's beginning to be accepted, not necessarily as the only word of truth, not as the final word of truth. I myself would not be surprised if a year or 5 or 10 or 20 from now, someone would look at the same text that I look at and would say, well, how could Sitchin miss, you know, this point and that point, that they're really talking about some kind of energy sources or whatever. The answer is, Bruce, that we are all products of our own technology. I could write about space and space travel because in my time we've come to know that this is feasible. 100 or 200 years ago, only somebody like, you know, Jules Verne could write, and this was a fiction, imagination. So it's being accepted. As a theory, as a plausible theory, some believe that there's no doubt that it all really happened. Some say, well, some things may have happened, some things I still may have a problem with it. But all I want, all I'm asking is that people who look at this evidence, both in text and in pictures, you know, each book has 150 to 170 illustrations, most of them from antiquity. So I'm asking people to have an open mind and evaluate the information. If I may mention, Bruce, the books are not available not only from Avon in paperback, they're also available in hardcover from Darren Company in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and some who want to really have permanent volumes in their libraries prefer to buy the hardcovers.
Is that Baron, B-A-R-O-N?
B-E-A-R, Bear and Company.
Oh, I see, okay. Let me ask you a question. That was very good, and I think that everybody really has gotten a good feeling about that. The crop circles. Some say that the crop circles are evidence that the Anunnaki are about to return. What do you think?
I mentioned that I was only recently at Salisbury, which is the epicenter where Stonehenge and Silver Hill and the Avery Circle are, and of course so many of the crop circles. I really don't know what to say about the crop circles. You know, first of all, there's the hesitation to accept them at face value, because even those who believe in them and write about them and talk about them and show documentaries about them admit that there's a lot of what they call hoaxing in that area. And some claim that they can distinguish between the real circles. By the way, it's not just circles by now, it's triangles and other shapes. And the hoaxing ones. To the extent that it is a real and genuine phenomenon, it is certainly very intriguing. It's intriguing in the shapes that appear. It's intriguing in the locations, as I said, so close to Stonehenge and other sites like that. And in Genesis Revisited, I discuss at length what I call the Phobos 2 incident, you know, the Soviet spacecraft that was lost as it tried to bombard the moonlet of Mars with laser beams back in 1989. Provide the sequence and evidence and photographs. In the book I show just a few, but I have many more, that I think it was not an accidental loss of the spacecraft. I believe that someone who is there just didn't like what they saw coming at them. And just as the incident of the Tower of Babel, when about 5,000 years ago, mankind tried to build what today we call a launch tower, and somebody came down from the heavens and looked at it and said, we are not going to let them do it. I think that there was some kind of a repetition of that event, and that the loss of the Soviet spacecraft was not an accident, but an incident in perhaps Star Wars incident. So I believe that the Anunnaki had a space base on Mars at the time. Sumerian texts refer to such a base. NASA pictures from the 1970s, apart from the famous face and so-called pyramids, show other structures, which I show in my book, Genesis Revisited. So I think that somebody has been reactivating that space base, whether it's the Anunnaki themselves or their emissaries, robots, hominids, that can also explain the UFO phenomenon and abductions and things like that. I think it's the latter. I don't think it's the Anunnaki themselves yet. But there is a process of return.
What do you think there's a time? I mean, you've studied so much, and of course, I'm sure that what you've actually had published is nothing compared to what you actually know. So let me see if you know something we'll never be able to read. is there a timetable that the Anunnaki have had, and we can maybe guess when they would return?
This is a difficult question to answer, and I'm saying this very truthfully. You see, for me, with so many people having read my books or seen me on television or heard radio interviews, etc., the books, by the way, have been translated into 9 languages, and 2 more are coming. The latest just signed up last month is Korean, by the way, of all places. So, you know, I'm well known and well read and much believed, you know, almost all over the world. And therefore, for me to just answer like that, you know, on a radio talk show, they're coming back whenever, tomorrow, next month, next year, etc., would be irresponsible. And this is one reason for hesitating. The other is that as I realized both from studies of celestial mechanics and the ancient records, the return of the planet to our vicinity and their coming and going do not coincide. In order for them to come and go and, you know, catch back either the same people or replacements, or you know, some came, some went, and so on, to do that, they have to come here. They have to come here before the planet is too close and thus assumes a tremendous speed. Now, this could be a difference of 200 years, of 300 years, maybe even of 600 years. I'm trying still to do more research and find the evidence from the last time that this happened in order to be able to pinpoint. And when I will give the answer, as I hope I'll be able to do, as soon as I'm sure of the answer, it will be an absolutely corroborated, evidenced answer and not just guesswork. So at this moment, I would not like to just guess or throw out dates or whatever, because it's not the way I write, it's not the way I do my research, and it would be irresponsible.
Well, that's fair, and I really like that. We have a few more minutes. Let me ask you this question. What do you say to theologians who may not really feel comfortable with the way that you describe the theory of creation of man?
Well, to theologians, it depends which ones, you know. They're not of one mind. But to theologians, I say that if anything that I do is I uphold the veracity of the Bible. And I also show, and this is not just for theologians, but for all people who consider themselves religious or believers, I show that the concept of an almighty, of a creator, of the supreme power in nature, of all those things that one can put into the term God with the capital G, and each one maybe puts it a little differently, that such an almighty is one not only of this speck of dust called earth, but of the whole universe. I show in my writings that we are not alone, and I show that our origins are from space. We are part of space. We are part of the universe. And I believe that just as somebody came here and for their own reasons and through genetic engineering did what they did and brought us about, really jumping the gun on evolution, because they would have come about anyway in another $5 or $10 million, I believe that that was their destiny, and that one day we will go out into space thinking that we are doing it for our own selfish reasons, but we'll also be fulfilling a kind of a destiny. So I think that I'm offering a universal theology, if you want to call it that, as compared with a limited parochial chauvinistic theology which would be geocentric. So I'm saying we are not the center of the universe. we are part of the universe.
Zechariah, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. If you have a moment, if you want to say something to our listeners before we get off the air, it's your moment.
Well, I've used the moment to thank you and say that it's always, I think the third time we're together on the air, and it's always a pleasure. And I promise to you and your listeners that if there's another book, they'll hear me on your program.
This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, and I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one.